If I must die, you must live to tell my story. To sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale.
If I must die, if I must die, if I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze, and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself. Sees the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment an angel is there, bringing back love, bringing back love, bringing back love. If I must die, if I must die, if I must die, let it bring hope, let it be a tale, let it bring hope, let it be a tale. If I must die,
hello everybody, welcome to episode, what is it?
82.
82 of the Lexel podcast. And Talal, would you like to
explain what that was? Alexi, you were sent this song. It is available on Bandcamp. It's called If I Must Die. It's by a collection of musicians up in Edinburgh called Giza. They've called themselves Giza. That's G-E-A-S-A. Beautiful there, with some cello and some pipes. The website is giza.bandcamp.com. Again, that's giza.bandcamp.com. You can donate any amount.
That's a famous poem, of course.
You can donate any amount and get a download of that song, and all money is going to medical relief for Palestine. They're not taking a penny from it. That is, of course, the lyrics there from the poem of the poet Rafat al-Arir, who was assassinated December 6th by the Israeli army. That's a very famous poem. I think I think every Palestine Relief fundraising event I've been to, there's been some actor on stage reciting that poem, hasn't there? Indeed. Including the one you and our guest were at.
We were talking before we began, we were talking about benefits over the years where, you know, I've done benefits where they say, you know, Kurdish rebels are being thrown into pits and shot and their bodies burned with acid. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Alexi Zale. So we've just provided you, Jen Brister, with a podcast version of that, really, haven't we? I'm sorry.
Here is one of the saddest songs you'll listen to today. Welcome, the comedian, Jen Brister.
It's how we roll. We're not afraid.
It is a powerful piece of work we did.
It really was, yeah. And we felt like it would be right to just open a podcast with it. Shivering. I'm still
I loved it. Just for the record, I think it's a beautiful song.
It's a poem. It's extraordinary. And then I think that setting is highly, adds to it, really. I think it's very powerful. And I hope the people, it helps. So, Jen Brister, we've got you on hoping to leech off your million and a half.
Yeah, leech away. leech away through the very heavy shadow ban, which has limited that million probably 15,000. But you're welcome to them.
Fuck, really? I didn't know. Well, there's no point then.
Why have you got me on? You'd be better off getting someone with 20,000 and no shadow ban than me, I tell you.
Is that how? Explain a shadow ban to our listeners or our readers back home, please.
The shadow ban is something that is created by an algorithm that I imagine is also created by Meta to limit certain speech and to limit certain subjects from becoming, having the potential to become viral. So I am very vocal about Palestine. And Meta is not happy about that. And so I've got a really big shadow ban on my account, which means that whilst I do have a million followers, all of my posts will be limited to about 17, 18, 20,000 people seeing it. Unless other people that don't have a shadow ban share my stories and share it. So but I had a conversation with Frankie Boyle about this, and he's given up using Instagram now. He just goes on Blue Sky because he said, nobody sees anything he's posting, so he doesn't see the point.
Yeah, indeed. And his Blue Sky doesn't is not owned by
It's not owned by the Empire yet. So he can say whatever he wants on there. But yeah, anyone that is vocal on a subject that Meta is unhappy about, you will get shadow banned. And that's why people are reluctant to talk about Palestine, because it means compromising their social media output.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
And it's
give a fuck. So.
I mean, have you noticed any real world effects because of this? Or are you able to get your, you know, your tour information out and so on in other ways? Or
I do notice it's harder for me to get, if I've got a post out where I'm talking about actually my job, comedy, and I go, oh, I'm doing this show and I'd love you to come to this, then it's a real ball ache because the algorithm is still like, oh, well, we're still just suppressing your account generally.
Yeah.
So then it can be annoying when I'm trying to sell a tour, which I am at the moment. But it's just one of those things. There's not really, and I don't really know if there's any way of shifting that shadow ban or if it's just there forever.
No, I suppose you can say, well, still being shadow banned and being hit by a drone coming through your windows.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, do you know what I mean?
It's a proportion, yeah.
Yeah, and I would rather be vocal about it and sleep at night than.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're very brave, I think. to do it. To just go back a bit, I noticed that you actually did the comedy module at the University of Middlesex. That's
right. Yeah.
Yeah. Was that with you, Thomas?
Yes, it was with you. Yeah. Back in 1996.
Yeah, well, because I met Hugh, I think he used to come to the original comedy store occasionally. And I actually bought a routine off him, which he was very kind to sell me, which is that about riding a motorbike, drop down a cog, give it a handful, come round and round about. It was his one good routine, really. I said, can I have? I paid him for it, but he said he very kindly let me have it, really. And it was a staple of my act for many years.
Oh, that's great.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Also, I didn't even know that Hugh, I suppose I did know that Hugh bobbed about at the comedy store in the 80s. I still see Hugh. Actually, I did a gig for him in a theatre in Deal in Kent for him last year. But yeah, he's on good form still.
Yeah, because it seemed kind of, because that was the first, I think I used to do a bit about it in my app, but that was the first kind of attempt to teach comedy, wasn't it? Rather than to approach it in some sort of chaotic fashion. There's a few courses. I mean, I think there's probably a lot of courses now. But
I think there's loads now.
Yeah.
But at the time, yeah, Hughes was the only one.
Yeah, I think I did teach there once. I mean, just give a talk once or twice.
It was great. I suppose you can't really teach comedy, but you can give people a few sort of notes and skills to use.
Yeah.
But comedy is like, you don't know how to be a comedian until you're gigging all the time and writing.
Yeah. It's one of those things that, you know, it doesn't exist unless you do it. You can't just think it, can you, really? It's
not Some people are just good at it naturally. Like, they've just got the natural timing. And even when you see them right at the beginning, you're like, well, the material's not quite there, but you've got something.
Yeah.
And then other people are really great at the writing. And then you watch them on stage and you go, you need to give that to someone else to say.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You're killing a brilliant joke.
you're murdering it. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, tell us about how you got into it, really, and, well, everything. Tell us everything about yourself. absolutely.
Let's start at the beginning. Leave nothing out. Strap yourself in for one of the most tedious stories of your life. That was the point when I did that course at Middlesex University in 1996. I had absolutely no desire to do stand-up comedy, but I was obsessed with comedy in general. And I used to go to the comedy store, and I used to go and I used to watch like everything. So I was a big fan of yours, Alexi.
Thank you.
And my brothers and I were, I suppose now you would call us nerds. Like, we watched absolutely any comedy that was on British television, because that's all we could access, was whatever was on terrestrial TV on the four channels. We watched it. It doesn't matter. It didn't matter if it was like, you know, the two Ronnies or the young ones or not the 9 o'clock news or French and Saunders or, you know, Hugh and Laurie, Smith and Jones, all of that. We were absolutely obsessed. And then we would watch, and then we would video. When we finally got a video recorder, then we would video stuff and then say shit back to each other. Like, even now that we're like in our 50s, there'll be like quotes from various Blackadder episodes or episodes of the Young Ones that we'll quote to us each other.
Have you ever thought about why that was, really, in your family?
No, I don't know. I just think it was something that was very a communal thing that we could do together that we really enjoyed. And, you know, I've got three brothers, and one of the ways that we really bonded was to rip the piss out of each other, which I think is a very British thing to do. So it was either getting each other in a headlock, which I was trying to avoid at all costs, or just breaking tension with jokes. And, you know, my brothers are all really funny and we all have a great sense of humor, but they had absolutely zero desire to do any kind of performance. And when I did that course, I suppose that was the first point where I went, oh, is this God, you could, this is a job. You could actually, because when I used to watch stand-up comedians, I thought they were just magicians.
You couldn't see what, yes.
I couldn't see how it worked. Had no idea how it worked. I couldn't see how they got there. I didn't understand the craft of stand-up, that a lot of it was written. I didn't know what was being improvised and what had been and what was like fixed. It all seemed like it had just come off the cuff, you know. And those you know, the really good comedians that could make you think that. And so the very idea that I could do that was just like a nonsense. No way. But then when I did that course and I got to see a little bit how the cogs work, I thought, maybe I could do this. So that's when it started. And then after that, I started to do open mics. And I was bad. I was so bad.
Yeah.
But I was kind of deluded. So I kept going.
But you have to have that confidence, I think, to succeed, you know.
Well, it sounds like getting your driving license. You learn how to drive after you've gotten your license, they always tell you. Isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean,
on the road.
Yeah, stand-up comedy. I mean, you can be the best student in the group, but it's meaningless until you get out there.
Was that a degree, a full-on degree?
It was a degree in theatre with a module on comedy.
Right.
Yeah, and we and at Middlesex University, and I don't know if they still have this, but they have a library. I think it's one of the only places in the country that has a library of almost every single comedy performance that has been on TV. They have a library of it. So that's everything, whether it be sketch comedy, stand-up comedy, they've got a library of every single performance. It's so if you want to say, oh, Joan Rivers in da-da-da-da-da, they've got it. It's wild. I don't know if I don't know if it's still there, because that particular comedy, that particular course at Ivy House, which is where the we were based, that doesn't exist anymore. So I don't know. It might not exist.
Really?
But
I wonder if there was a Jim Davidson section.
Oh, sure. Oh, God. There was. There was Jim Davidson. Yeah. Roy Chubby Brown.
That's the one. I wanted to pull him, but I kept thinking Fatty Arbuckle. I'm like, that's not his name.
No.
Roy Chubby Brown.
Who were you? Go on, Sam.
But I think it was really different. Like when I used to watch stuff in the early 90s, even, and it was probably a bit of a leftover from the 80s.
Yeah.
It just felt a bit more. Well, it was very much more man-heavy for a start, and much more white, but it was just felt a bit more anarchic.
Yeah. I mean, but by 96, I'd actually sort of come and gone, hadn't I, really? I don't think. I was like, I've been intensely in fashion, and now it was very out of fashion. You know, I did a bit, I think, in Sandwich Bar about 1990s Alexis Sale, you know, sort of hanging around the Zanzibar Club with Anthony Worrell Thompson, you know, and sort of, you know, other figures from the 90s in his Armani suit, you know, trying to figure out quite where his career had gone.
What happened to Anthony Worrell Thompson?
I don't know what you remember. He was arrested for shoplifting cheese.
Oh, that's right.
I think for his restaurant, I think it was like, I'm not sure, but I think a lot of chefs are, you know,
alcoholics
or drug users. And I think his empire was collapsing because he branded all, you could buy Anthony Worrell Thompson branded frying pans, couldn't you? And
when he was, that was peak Anthony Worrell Thompson. Jamie Oliver's taken over, but...
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what, us 90s rejects, like me and Anthony Worrell, we still see each other. And, you know, Anthony Costa from Blue and is he 1990s?
Late 90s, noughties. Noughties, maybe? I don't know.
We've recreated the Zanzibar Club, which was a kind of prototype of the Groucho, which was in... We've rebuilt it in a basement in Deal in Kent. And, I don't know how far I can go with this.
He's there.
Yeah.
He hosts it, actually. Still selling material.
You see, the in deal, that's right, you put it in.
Yeah.
So who are your cohort? Who are you coming up with? And who would that be?
Well, I because I did this thing of going in and then coming out and then going back in. So I didn't commit. But I guess when I was first starting, I don't know, it would have been people like Alan Carr, Nina Conti, who else? I'm just trying to think. Like that sort of time. And then I guess a little bit later was Russell, all the Russells. Russell
good
Howard,
and bad.
Russell Kane, yeah, Russell Brand, yeah, all the
in
Russell.
In fact, are there any good Russells, really? Yeah.
Yeah, so those were the people that were coming up. Sort of sidestep the Russells.
Yeah.
And
who's the other one? The Joshes. There's no good Joshes.
Listen, Alexa, you can't have me on your podcast.
Slagging off
my peers.
I'm sorry.
I'll be cancelled. So it was the Russells, and then it was
a old man from the 90s. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was very at that time when I was coming up. There was very little space for women, and there certainly was no space for some gobby lesbian. And it was I really feel like what people wanted, certainly what TV people wanted, was young men in t-shirts. In stretchy t-shirts and faded jeans, at talking about, you know, their trials and tribulations of being a white guy, and they didn't. I found that time for me was very frustrating because it was very difficult for me to break in, even into the clubs. It was very much a one woman on a bill, and I feel like every time I was performing, it was an audition rather than a gig. And it was like, let's see how good you are. And, you know, I felt like the men really had their feet under the table, but I never once felt like I had my feet under the table. So I approached every single gig like it was Live at the Apollo.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Because this
is my job, and if they don't ask me back, I don't get another weekend here, then I can't pay my rent. So I felt like there was a lot of, I'm going to say, people that were quite blasé about their work, and I was not blasé ever about stand-up. I was really serious, and I needed to walk away from every gig feeling like I was...
Right. I mean, it's not fair that situation pertained with the maleness of the take. On the other hand, that struggle is not a bad thing to go through. I think, I don't know if you feel like that about it, but your attitude seems to have been the right, you know.
I think I needed that struggle to get good at stand-up and actually, you know, with my personality, because I'm quite stubborn, if I feel like someone's trying to stop me from doing something, rather than going, oh, I guess I'll never make it, I have to prove to everybody that I can do it. So in fact, not to everybody, to myself, that's who I'm proving it to. And I suppose, yes, having that struggle made me work a lot harder and made me realize I had to be not just good, but I had to prove that I was almost better than everybody in the room to be seen, to be accepted, and to get more work. And that was no bad thing. And I still, to be honest with you, Alexi, I still feel like that. I don't feel any different about comedy. I always feel like I need to work really hard in order to convince people that I should be there, that I'm allowed to be in.
Which is, you know, I've grown lazy and complacent over the last few years, but your attitude is better, really.
Oh, I'm looking forward to lazy and complacent. I can't
it's
wait
a good,
for that.
It's a lovely place to be. It is.
I want to be there in 10 years, please.
Well, I think you need to be old and harmless, and then I think it's only when you can get to that place. Then I think I remember reading somewhere in France that, you know, once you sort of reach a certain level of celebrity, then you can never go away. People will come and laugh and enjoy whatever you do, no matter what tremendous crap it is, really. I'm at that stage. No.
I don't think I'm likely to ever reach that level.
No, I mean, I think, yeah. No, I mean, for me, just, I mean, because, I mean, that that, I mean, there's still a lot of that drive. I think you do, you know, it does make, I mean, it, there are, as you say, there are performers who don't have that and get by on, you know, either social advantage or, but I mean, it's no bad thing, I think, to have that drive. So what changed anyway? I mean, how did things improve for you then?
I think I got some good advice from my mum at the time. I was kind of doing a little bit of radio stuff. I was doing a little bit of sketch writing and sketch performing stuff. But in my head, I always wanted to be a stand-up comedian. And my mum just said, why are you doing all these other things?
Right.
Stop doing all of these other things that you're not passionate about and you don't really enjoy. When you love stand-up comedy, just do stand-up.
Right.
And it was kind of like a lightning bolt. I was like, yeah, she's absolutely right. Why am I doing all this? I don't even enjoy it. I get nothing from it. It's not my personality at all. I think I was trying to figure out what success was.
Yeah.
So I realized success is just it's an ephemeral thing. It's not, and it never, whenever you achieve whatever success is, it's not, you don't think of yourself as successful. So I just thought, right, okay. I put my head down and I made a decision that I was just going to do everything I could to be the best stand-up comedian that I could be within whatever abilities I have as a human being. And that's what I did. And it took me 10 years. And at the end of that 10 years, I got Live at the Apollo for the first time.
Right.
And then that's when... after I did the first Live at the Apollo, and it was very gradual after that. It wasn't like a big seismic break and all of a sudden things started to shift. But after that was the first big shift for me was doing Live at the Apollo for the first time. And then gradually, you know, it's taken another 7-8 years. And I can't remember when I did that.
It's rarely overnight any of this kind of like explosive success kind of thing, isn't it? And that's probably a good thing because you probably, not yourself, but like it would be hard to be prepared if you're suddenly in extremely high demand and you might get stretched too thin and stuff. So it's probably a good thing that it doesn't.
Definitely good for me because I wouldn't have been able to deal with it. And by the time I got to the point where I was being offered things and saying, do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? Because I've got so many gremlins on my shoulder anyway, by the time I was like, oh, do you want to do Mock the Week or do you want to do this or do you want to do that? If it had been 10 years earlier, I'd have been like, oh my God, I can't do that. I'm not good enough to do that. I was like, oh, I've done my time. I can do it. Right. I can do it. It'd be fine.
Yeah. So now you're actually, you're touring. You have your own show now, which goes out in large venues, is that?
Yeah, I'm...
Tell us about your upcoming tour, Jen.
I'm going to tell you about my upcoming tour. Thank you, Talav, for crowbarring that in. Well, I go to New Zealand in a week, so I start my tour in the New Zealand Comedy Festival, and then I'm touring Australia, and then my UK and Ireland tour begins in October of this year, 2025, and then it will go straight through into 2026, and we're adding more dates.
What sort of venues will you?
Well, it's a mixed venue. So I'm doing like I think Bristol Old Vic, for example, that's 400 plus. Right. And then I'm doing the Apollo in London at the Eventim Apollo, which is an insane amount of people. So it varies from place to place, I like that. I like that mix of venues. So, you know, I'll be doing bigger venues in places like Birmingham and London and Manchester and smaller venues in Cornwall. You know, venues in Cornwall.
But still, you're taking your message to the people of Cornwall who want to hear it. How do you, like, I mean, I don't know if anybody else, I mean, I'm always interested in the logistics. I had a tour manager actually who just died, but he knew the distance from the power sockets to the stage. You knew where all the power sockets were in every venue in Europe.
What? Oh my God.
He toured with a lot of bands and stuff as well.
I mean, I was just going to say, can I have his number? But he's sadly dead. No. Yeah, this will be, so this is my fourth tour, and this will be the first time I have a tour manager, because I've never had a tour manager before.
Really? Shit, that's tough. How will you travel then? What will you travel in? Name the vehicle and the tour manager.
It'll be a Toyota Yaris. I don't know, actually. The last tour I did was like an insane tour. I did 115 dates, and I organized all the travel, and I mainly went by train, and sometimes one of my supports would drive to venues, but on the whole, I was I organized it all myself, including hotels.
Wow, really? So you do your own?
I did everything. Almost. Yeah.
Fucking hell, really? Jesus.
And but this time my tour producer is great, and they are organizing my hotels and stuff and all of that. So I don't have to do
Which
that.
Which promoter is it?
This, his name's Paul Willis, and he's amazing, and he's doing an incredible job. And I haven't got a tour manager organized yet, but I think I'm going to get one, somebody that can hold my hand and deal with all the stuff when you come in, so you don't have to deal with all that, and then I can just go and sit in my dressing room and do the show.
Yeah.
So this will be the first tour that I do that, and I'm excited to have someone some help.
I'll fucking do it. So I get to come with you to New Zealand and Australia.
I literally wish I could have a tour manager with me in Australia and New Zealand, but I can't afford it because the rooms aren't big enough. But, you know, when I hit the big time, I'll give you a call, mate.
He'd be a good tour manager, I think.
Yeah. I think you'd be bored, Talal.
I think it's on my last tour.
I'm a professional at maximising my time off. Like, I'll have like 3 hours to myself, and I'd go to a zoo, do a bungee jump, climb the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and then be back in the hotel.
And then back in time for the show.
The show, yeah.
God, I like that. God, you've like...
You have to
that's
get
that's
right.
Intimidating.
I, years ago, because I was friendly with Victoria Wood for a while, and she had a tour. Yeah, she was, people thought she was shy, and she wasn't actually. She was extremely confident arrogant in that way, in a good way.
Good for
but
her.
She had she could find herself bullied by people, and she did. I remember her telling this to a tour manager that wouldn't iron her, say, "Can you iron my top? I'm about to go on in front of 3,000 people," and they'd say, "No." And I think she learned. She got some steel eventually, but I think in her sort of early days of big success, she'd often. I had a tour manager on my last tour. I think which. I mean, who had sex with every female receptionist in every hotel that we stopped off at. Yeah, so he wasn't exactly concentrating either. you need to get the right person.
The way he's really slotted in the time there. He's really maximised the spare time he has.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, what sort of cubicles have you got available just to bang on out before I take Alexi to work?
Well, they could always find an empty room, I think.
I don't know. The cleaning cupboard. Here we go.
But a good tour manager is I have Linda with me as well, my wife. So your partner wouldn't come with you?
No, she'd rather drag her face down a pebble dash wall than do that. That's not her thing. I mean, the very idea that she'd come with me to watch me perform every night, no.
Really?
She'll come once. That's very good. And then bye-bye. But also, we've got young children, so it would be impossible as well for her to come. But even, Alexi, even if we didn't, she just... Also, let's be honest, touring isn't fun. It's not like super fun. No. It's a lot of like, when people say to me, "You're taking the family?" No, because I'm going to be in like Wellington 2 days, Auckland a day, fly to Melbourne 3 days, Canberra 1 day, Brisbane 3 days. Then I'm going to Melbourne again, Sydney. I'm like, the children would be like, "What the fuck are we doing? This is horrendous."
Yeah.
What I would like to do is to be able to go and do a tour where I can spend a, have a few more gaps between and then be able to take the family out and then have like a little holiday at the end of it. That's what I'd like, but I just can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, at the moment, it's not affordable. It's a long way to go, Australia.
It is a long way. One of the things I'm interested in is business class seating.
Oh, God. I did my first business. No, I'm not going business class, am I? Fuck. But I flew. Someone flew me business class to Australia last year to do a gig. Yeah. And I couldn't. And I've never flown business class or anything close to anything outside of economy.
Right.
And I literally don't know how I'm ever going to
fly
again.
No, it's impossible. Yeah.
I just can't believe that all of these years, these fucking pricks have been up front, living the Vida Loca up there while I've been crammed in the back with my knees up to my chin, eating with plastic cutlery. I mean, I was excited I got a gin and tonic once. Well, I'm sorry, but I got to business class, Alexi, and they offered me an old fashioned. And I was like, this is absolutely out of, you know.
It's wild.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Bag of gummy bears. Why? Just because. Okay.
Yeah.
There was nuts, as many nuts as you wanted. They had a pot full of pastries that you could just go in and help yourself.
Yeah.
M&Ms were just like flowing like, water.
There's on the double decker planes.
It was,
there's even was like a bar. There's like a bar lounge.
There
you
was
just
a,
go and hang
there,
out.
There was a bar. I was on the double decker thing. There was a blinking bar.
The Airbus A380.
Yeah.
Sorry,
the technical term. Yeah.
Anyway, that'll be the one and only time I do it, but it was lush.
Alexi, there is.
You'll get there.
I've had a couple emails suggesting the prospect of us doing a live podcast in Australia. What would you think about that? Would you be asked to fly out there? If they took care of it all?
I've been to Australia 7 times.
I know. That's the thing that I'm like scared that you would just be like, nah, I can't be fucked. And I'm like, all right, I guess we won't go to Australia.
You gotta go.
I can't see that the economy would work out, but
well, you do have a fan base there. And
if they could make it work economically, but it would have to be club class and all that shit, you know. So, but I've done that before.
Okay. I mean, if you're gonna go, don't do what I'm doing and go to Australia when it's winter there. You've got to go when it's winter here, summer there. Because I've really messed up big time going out now.
Brisbane and that'll be all right. It'll be sunny up there.
Brisbane will be nice, and I've got 3 days there, so I will get sunshine in Brisbane. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, yeah. Brisbane. That's the only time it's ever happened to me. I had that where, and I don't really know why, I did a tour there in 1990, and it was one of those, you know, where we took off and we were putting in extra dates, and I was like on the news when I got there, and for some reason I was just briefly, and I found that in hotels there's secret floors where you get like special, the secret floors, which are like where you have like a butler, and you have to have like a special key to get off at that floor.
Oh wow!
And I was staying.
Hotels is this?
Most of them.
They have a special floor.
Yeah, there's a special celebrity floor with a. They have their own cocktail bars and stuff like that. Yeah, and that's the only time I ever graduated to the secret floor, though. And then I went back, like, I think I left it too long. I went back in 96, I think it was. Yeah. And, rather than putting in extra dates, we were taking dates out.
Oh God!
Well, no, but we didn't. We sold the dates we could, but we didn't. And the promoter
you just didn't add the extra ones.
Yeah, we just didn't add the extra ones. But the promoter ended up owing me money, and they televised. You remember when Michael Hutchence died? They televised his funeral. And the promoter was one of the pallbearers. But also there was a friend of mine who was another pallbearer, Andy Gill from the Gang of Four, also dead. And so I was thought of ringing Andy and saying, because he was live on the telly, he said, that bloke behind you carrying Michael Hutchence's coffin, he owes me 5,000 Australian dollars. Can you asking.
Can you have a word?
Yeah, can you have a word with him about that?
Mate, I've got Alexi on the blower.
Yeah, Alexi's on the phone. Harley, you owe me. He says you owe me 5,000 Australian dollars.
I hate that with that. That is classic promoter, isn't it? Is there? There's always. I don't know what it was like back in your day, but there's always promoters. But every comedian knows, absolutely notoriously, that never pay, and yet everyone still works for the prick. And you see the conversations going around on Facebook and stuff. Why has so-and-so not paid? Blah, 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 blah. I was like, why do we keep working for them if we know they're not going to pay?
It's kind of it's just the eternal optimism of comedians, I suppose, isn't it? I mean, I've been very lucky, really, that I started out with the McIntyres, and then I went with David Johnson, password promoter, and they're both very good, really. But
you mean Phil McIntyre?
I was the first anyone's thinking he ever did.
Really?
Yeah. Before me, he was doing a guy called Blaster Bates, who was a demolition expert.
This sounds so gave
talks.
To me.
I know. He gave talks about blowing up chimneys, and he had a psychic called Doris Stokes. That's what Phil McIntyre was doing. Ask him about that. Tell Phil McIntyre, biggest comedy. And I was the first comedy act that he did.
So Phil McIntyre is one of the oldest comedy producers, promoters. Yeah. Wow, I did not know that.
No, he was, he did the Young Ones tour, and that's how he became Ben Elton's manager and stuff like that. But he was Ent's, I mean, like a lot of them, he was Ent's secretary, I think, at Preston Polytechnic. And I think he had a t-shirt printing firm and stuff like that. And he did heavy metal bands. And then somehow he did a few dates on my very first tour. And then eventually I gave him exclusive, rights.
Okay. It's a wash with promoters, producers now. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, it must be, it's a game that attracts sharks, isn't it, really? I mean, I think it's...
I've been very fortunate with the ones that I've had who have not been sharky at all, but very sort of... very transparent about the money and all of that. So, but yes, it does. Anything where you're taking creaming money off someone else tends to attract sharks.
It's capitalism. I mean, it was in the early days because we were all so defined. There was no circuit. When I started, there was no circuit. There were no venues, We were inventing it all for the first time. So you could either somebody, in some towns, you'd just get somebody who was the local fantasist, and you didn't really know, you couldn't work it, it was just like a lunatic in Loughborough or somewhere,
With a vision.
That he couldn't fulfill.
I mean, that's still the same today. Really? I mean, I've just listened to you going, that these people are still going.
So you you end up in a fucking old age pensioners care home or something, performing on milk crates.
And you walk in and they hand you a mic and go, and you go, where's the stage? And they go, just there in the corner. And you go, and there's just people milling around. And you're like, when does the comedy start? Whenever you walk on stage. You're like, there is no stage.
Yeah.
It's just me in the middle of a room having a breakdown. What is this? This is a nightmare.
I mean, people don't realise that they see, also they, I mean, again, they see you being funny on a stage with lights and a sound system and an audience that's paid, and they think you can therefore be funny anywhere, that you can be in the back room of their meat warehouse, that you can... you can do it there. And of course, it's entirely contextual, isn't it? It is. It's not.
But people don't know that. And the thing is, it's really hard to explain to people. Stand-up comedy is really hard when everything is in place.
Yes.
It still can be an absolute shit show.
Yeah.
So if you take any of those things away, take away the lights, take away the microphone, take away the stage, then we are, to all intents and purposes, fucked. Now, every now and again, it might still work.
Yes.
It might still work, but that's not because it works. That's because we got lucky.
Yeah. Or your skill as well.
Your skill,
You push to kind of,
But Yeah, all of that sort of going.
Have you ever played the Glastonbury Cabaret Tent?
Oh, yeah. I'm going again this year. So this will be my fourth year in a row of Glasto Cabaret. But the thing with Glastonbury is, and the Cabaret Tent is great, by the way, and there's always loads of stuff going on. But one, most people don't know what's going on in the Cabaret Tent because they haven't gone to Glastonbury to... to see comedy. So, you know, that person, often there's a person playing the Cabaret Tent that you know, people say to me, oh, I didn't realize you were at Glastonbury. And I've always wanted to see you do stand up. And I'm like, well, I don't know what to tell you. I've put it on my social media. Maybe the shadow ban did get in the way a little bit. But, you know, people don't look to see what's happening in the Cabaret Tent. And often the people that, the comedians that they can't get tickets for the rest of the year, they're there. They're going to be there. And you can just waltz in and they'll be doing a half an hour set, you know? So
it's a huge room.
It's fucking
huge. I love it. We love it. Me and Alexi were there last year. I'm going to be back this year. It's fucking huge room. Huge, tall, tall ceiling. There's loads of sound bleeding in from some clown show across the field.
Yeah.
Juggling antics and fire breathing, all that. And it's just blasting in through the canvas walls. And it's a hard one to do for your first, like, I was going to ask you for advice, basically, because I haven't had a gig in fucking months, and I don't have any booked before Glastonbury. So started to shit myself a bit. But I remember just enjoying it when I just took my time and took it real slow and just enjoyed it for myself. And then, a room like that. I don't know. I feel like they should have a curtain in the middle of the room to kind of.
There's a cross between a venue and a stable, isn't it? Really, because there's straw on the floor and everything.
And it depending on, you're right. So, and also it depends what time you're doing it and what's happening. If there's suddenly some sort of brass band street performer, suddenly
we had that.
Just plants itself outside your cabaret, outside while you're on, which happened to me, I think, the second year. And all you could hear was some tuba and a trombone going at it. You know, it's quite hard to keep your focus, but.
So what's your approach and what's your mentality before you step out on that?
Just get through it. Just get through it. Like, don't keep your expectations low. Don't expect to hear any laughter and just plow on until that's 30 minutes. Off.
Yeah.
I think if you go with any expectation, because I think, you know, when you hear, I'm going to be playing Glastonbury and you think, wow, this is going to be great. And then you walk on and you're like, this is a massive tent and there's 12 people. One of them looks like they're on ketamine. Okay. You know, you've got to steel yourself for the fact that there's not many people in a very, very big tent, in a very, very big space.
And they're spread out as well.
And they are spread out. So you've got to see, what I do is and. Don't speed up because then your half an hour set, what you'll do in 10 minutes. So it's a little bit of pacing around, a little bit of talk, a little bit of chit chat, a little bit of like going into the crowd a bit. If you feel like the energy's dropping, acknowledge what's happening in the, because sometimes something absolutely bananas will be happening and the comedian doesn't acknowledge it. And I'm like, dude, you can't continue your set when, you know, a French theatrical troupe is singing, you know, Frère Jacques outside. You've got to acknowledge, always acknowledge what's happening in the space.
Yeah.
And if you keep your expectations low and you don't think, oh God, this is a reflection on me. It's no reflection on you because literally it's only full for James Acaster and Nish Kumar. Then you'll just enjoy it.
Yeah.
I think just dick about, and then once your set is over, just go out and enjoy Glastonbury because that's why we're there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just to, we haven't covered nearly your many aspects of your life, but having attained this success, you decided to blow it all by supporting Palestine, basically.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that I've blown it, but it certainly makes people uncomfortable, and it certainly splits a room. But I came to the conclusion quite quickly that I would rather have in my audience a room full of people that shared my values and shared the things that I believe in.
Yeah.
And for that reason, I was willing to, at the time, I didn't know if it was going to be a sacrifice or not, to be honest, of just being, speaking out for what I believed in, which I completely 100% in every single bone of my body believe in. So it didn't feel like a big deal at the time. People have kept telling me it's a big deal, and I have lost work. I'm not naive. I have lost work, and I'm sure there's work I didn't even know that's out there that I haven't gotten because of it. I'm sure, but I stand by my decision. And in time, if I'm not vindicated soon, I will be. And I think everyone really, I think if you've got a platform, I believe personally that you should be using it.
Yeah, it's the I think it's the great moral question of our age. We didn't ask to be, the actions of Israel, in its various manifestations. If you're not vocal about this, what are you going to be vocal about? I think, really,
Yeah.
And those that stay silent are condemned by their silence, I think.
I think that's everyone.
Yeah.
Somebody said to me, Jen, you're quite judgmental, which I try not to be. And I think I'm a lot less judgmental than a lot of my friends on the left. And I try, because I don't think it's very helpful, because what I want is for people to be involved. And I don't give a shit when you get involved. I don't care if it's tomorrow. Please join us. I'd love to have you. That's my view and opinion. But a friend of mine said to me, Jen, there's lots of people doing stuff, but you just don't know about it, And I went, well, if I don't know about it, it doesn't count. It's meaningless. No. I mean, if I don't know that they're doing it, it's absolutely fucking meaningless.
They're doing it in their heads.
Yeah, like they're very cross-gen. You just don't know about it. Well, then it doesn't mean anything. If they're not vocal about it, if I can't see them, if they're not making a stand, if they haven't said out loud, then if they're donating money in the background, it's kind of... That's okay. I'm glad if that assuages your guilt. Yeah. But it doesn't make a tangible difference. And bravery comes in numbers. The more people that are vocal, then that gives other people the bravery to come forward. Because lots of people are going, this feels wrong, right? But the propaganda of the Israeli PR machine has made people afraid. What if I say this? Will I be cancelled? What if I do this? Will I lose my job? It's like, you're going to be okay. And I think now, maybe not a year ago when it was but I think we can see the mask has slipped.
Yeah, yeah, the holes are starting to show. It's true.
And the wheels are falling off. When you've got a Tory politician standing in Parliament denouncing Israel, the rats are leaving the sinking ship, baby. You can join in now. I mean, I will say it's quite late, but please do join.
I agree completely.
Well, Jen, where can people buy tickets for your bloody tour, huh? And other shows, and find out more about your gigs and shit.
Yes,
you got a website, Jen.
I've got a website. I've got a website to love. So it's jenbristol.co.uk. You can find all of my shows there. Mm-hmm. Please, there'll be more dates added. I think we've got a Leeds date coming up. And we've got some more dates in the southwest of England coming up, we haven't announced yet. So keep an eye on that. But there's plenty of shows already up and on sale. And also, if you're in London, I'm the Apollo next year. So please do.
Yeah.
It's big. It's a big bloody.
Can we mention the July thing?
We can. So I also would like to say that I am involved with helping to put on a show for Health Workers for Palestine at the Trotsky on the 19th of July. I have asked Alexei to be there.
It's
as well.
Put me on the spot. I have to do it now.
On
yeah.
his podcast. No, no, I'm busy. Now, unfortunately, he is obliged now to do it. Does he have one in deal as well? I just want to know. Just asking for a friend. Just in case.
Got a great basement.
So Tickets aren't available. I don't know when tickets are going to be on sale for that, but it'll be on sale very soon. So keep an eye out for that. All money raised goes to health workers for Palestine. And it's going to be a really insane event with loads and loads of people, that musicians and comedians and lots of famous actor people.
I'm sure
speaking.
That'll be on the Trotsky's website when the tickets
are
available.
It's actually pronounced Trotsky. It's not pronounced Trotsky, is it? Trotsky.
Oh shit! It's not Trotsky, is it? It's Trotsky. But you know, whenever I've played at the Trotsky, I've called it the Trotsky. I've just turned into my mother.
It's like my mother called. She could never get her head around Wagamama. She called it Wackety Annie's.
Wackety Annie's is harder to say than Wagamama's.
Well, you know.
All right, go to the Troxy's websites intermittently and check if they put tickets up. Go to jenbrister.co.uk. If you're at Glastonbury, come see Jen Brister or myself doing our sets there. And fucking please, to support the show and keep the wheels a turning and keep us in business, go to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. That's patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. Just a few pennies, please, sir or madam. Or them, please come and just throw please, some pennies in my pocket, please.
Please, sir.
It would, alms for the poor. Alms for the poor. patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. Email us at polexki@slpodcast.gmail.com. Follow us, AlexisLPod, on all the socials. Thank you, Jen Brister, for being here.
Thank you very much, Jen.
Thank you so much, both of you. What a laugh.
Alexi, last words.
Bye, Mike.
Free Palestine.
You've been listening to the AlexisL podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.